Reset your system clock to 1992 and join us on today's multimedia hyperguide tour of Windows 3.1. Hi folks, it's your friend SuperVGA once again. I'm finally glad to be back with you to talk about the classic simulator for Windows, SimFarm. So hello everybody, I'm sorry about the extended break, that was completely unexpected, but I talked about that in my previous point release of a podcast. Today I'm really excited to talk about SimFarm, but before we get to that, I'll give you a bit of an update on where I've been, how I've been doing. In preparation for this episode, I've actually been playing a couple of farming games. First of all, I've been playing SimFarm, of course, but I recently got started on the indie kind of mega star, I don't know what to call it, Stardew Valley. That's been a very enjoyable experience. I was told it was kind of like a Harvest Moon slash farming simulator game. I'm starting to get a better sense for what the game is. It definitely is a remake of Harvest Moon, but it's also, in fact, in many ways, much more of an RPG than anything else. I wouldn't say that it's much of a farming simulator. In fact, it abstracts out a lot of the complexities of farming itself from the game and focuses a little bit more on a little bit of an arcade style experience more than anything else. But I'm enjoying it very much, and it's a nice little break from the hardcore simulation aspects of SimFarm. Now, I got a wonderful email from one of our listeners, and finally able to cover it. This is in relation to the Indiana Jones and His Desktop Adventures podcast. This is from listener Ben. Greetings, SuperVGA. I've been listening to your podcast, enjoying the many memories it's reawakened. We never had a Windows 3.x machine at home, but my grandparents had a PC running 3.11, and my best friend had a machine running 3.1. So I spent plenty of time in that operating system. I've never played Indiana Jones and His Desktop Adventures, but I especially enjoyed your latest episode because I remember playing the demo of Star Wars Yoda Stories over and over and being very fond of the simple gameplay and clean graphics. I replayed it a few years ago, and while it definitely hasn't aged as well as TIE Fighter or Dark Forces, I can see why I liked it back then. It felt a bit more like a toy or a board game than those challenging playable film-style titles, which I can finish now, but I certainly couldn't back then. Listeners will no doubt remember such titles as Cats and Dogs, a favorite of mine, and Creatures, which also felt like toys to play with. One board game type piece of Windows 3.x software I especially hope you cover at some point is the wonderful Gazillionaire. It was a great trading game with wonderfully weird and wonky alien creatures and all sorts of fun made-up words. I probably played more of this than even the legendary Ski Free. Ben, I will definitely talk about Ski Free in the future. And the man who introduced me to it was the father of one of my friends, the same man who introduced me to Civilization 2. To say that he's responsible for many of my childhood hours wasted is definitely no exaggeration. What fine times those were, and what wonderful games. Thanks for your fine episodes so far, and I hope to share in more of your memories of that time in the future. Signed, Ben. Well, Ben, that's wonderful. There's a lot to reply to here. You commented a bit later on that you did eventually install Indiana Jones and His Desktop Adventures, and we chatted a little bit about the problems you had with quest completion. The game, at least your copy of the game, seemed to be a little bit buggy. I was okay completing quests, but you mentioned several times that every time you got near the end of a quest, there would be some sort of showstopper, some critical item couldn't be either placed or used. That was really sad to hear that. I've been playing off of my original floppy disks. I'm not sure if the game was patched later on, But it's possible that one of the abandonware sites out there, which is unfortunately the only way to get the game these days, maybe has a slightly buggy copy. I wish I had a little bit more to offer there, but I agree with you. Neither Yoda Stories nor Indiana Jones and His Desktop Adventures have aged quite as well as TIE Fighter or Dark Forces. Those are slightly, I would say, not just slightly, much better examples of licensing used in LucasArts titles. At the same time, there is something very enjoyable. These games are such a small experience compared to the huge experiences TIE Fighter and Dark Forces offer. Those are the kind of games you can't sit down and play for 5 to 10 minutes. My experience is I get sucked in for about a good 45 minutes to 2 hours in each of them. Although, I have to note that I tend to get extreme motion sickness from playing Dark Forces these days. I'm not sure if my body's changed or perhaps with the change of monitor types, no longer using CRTs, or maybe it's the resolution the monitor size now. But I tend to get pretty severe headaches and to the point of almost vomiting playing Dark Forces, so I don't play that so much anymore. On the topic of cats and dogs, I'm really happy to report to you, Ben, that very recently I came across box copies of not only Cats and Dogs, but also Cats and Dogs 2, the sequels. So those are going to be fun episodes to do because I also have some great memories of those, and I'll be looking forward to talking about them. Hopefully I'll be able to get a little bit more info on the development of those titles because they were actually very important in the early Windows 3.1 software toy or game origins of that operating system. So wonderful. Oh, and you mentioned Gazillionaire. I know that listener Brian also is a huge fan of Gazillionaire, and I suspect he'd be very excited I talk about that game. So absolutely. I'm not a huge player of strategy titles or economic simulators, so it might take me a little while to get to it, but I definitely will. I know Brian's been really hurting on me for years to play the game, and I know I promised I would. Finally, Ski Free. I can't wait to talk about this game. I have wonderful memories of this playing in my mother's university computer lab when I was a very, very young boy. Ski Free, as well as I can't remember the name of the title right now. It's the Mouse Trap, and it's not called Mouse Trap. It's Mouse Something. Rodent's Revenge. There we go. Got it. It's one of those Microsoft Entertainment Pack games that I fell in love with as a child. My sister, being the consummate professional playing Jez Ball under the same package. So yes, Ski Free. I've got a great story about Ski Free, as well as a wonderful development story to talk about in that game coming up soon. So thanks again, Ben, and to anyone else. I love getting your memories on the air. So please write in with anything you got. It doesn't have to be pertain to the most recent episodes. So please write in. Email address is vga@vga256.com. That's vga@vga256.com. So rolling back to a previous conversation we had in, I believe it was episode 5, remember that I thought that a young kind of teenager had designed or created QuickTime VR. I was off. I was actually way, way off on that story, but there was a bit of a kernel of truth there. What happened was I was reminded of the story of Canadian developer, adolescent developer, Tom Williams, kind of boy entrepreneur who was hired by Apple at 14 years old. So the part I misremembered was that Tom Williams did in fact do Apple software development at 14 years old and was hired by Apple at the same age. The part of the story I got a little munged, or perhaps the news clip that I saw as a teenager got munged on TV, was Tom was developing QuickTime software using the conferencing API that a friend of him a friend of his and him had worked on. And what it used was QuickTime's conferencing API allowed you to develop any kind of interface you could put on top of the basic video conferencing function. And what they had done was built this Star Trek-like LCARS, if anybody is familiar with TNG, LCARS-style interface. That's the very clean, modern-looking interface seen in Star Trek The Next Generation. Tom, in his story, talks about how that it was visually appealing and kind of met a geek quotient. And what happened was he had developed this piece of software, and months earlier, after basically calling Apple every day and requesting to talk to John Sculley, he was invited to WWDC. That's the worldwide, it's the Apple Developers Connection kind of yearly conference they have. I can't remember the exact meaning of the acronym. He scored an interview and a conversation with John Sculley. And Sculley actually called him at his home. And after this, I think, took about a year of wrangling between going to WWDC as a 13 or 14-year-old and getting the call from John, he was hired at Apple. And anyway, this got kind of mixed up in my memory, and that's why I thought it was QuickTime VR related. So that's a little bit on that story. Now, for this week's inventory check, it's not going to be something that came out of came in the mail. It's going to be something that I've actually owned for quite some time. This is a copy of the I've got just the manual and the CD because this is how it came when I was a child. This was a pack-in with our IBM PS1, a game called Iron Helix by Spectrum Holobyte, who I believe was the publisher at the time, and the company Drew Pictures. This was a very early CD-ROM multimedia title for Windows 3.1, and I don't want to make any judgment on this game, but I can tell you that it did not hold my attention for very long when I was a child. I was very attracted to the idea of it having full motion video, as well as very interesting 3D pre-rendered 3D graphics. But the gameplay was not the most exciting thing, and I quickly put it away. So recently, when I was going through my game collection, I found this stuffed away under a bunch of other boxes, and I thought I would pull it out. So this will definitely be a future episode, getting to talk about Iron Helix, and probably Drew Pictures, who also went on to develop the title... Bad Mojo, the Roach game, under the studio Pulse Entertainment, and published by Acclaim. This is another game that I do want to talk about. This one has been probably talked about a little bit more often, just because it was released on GOG.com. So those are the titles which will be coming up. So when I got Sim Farm, it was 1994. I was in the 10th grade, and we had pretty recently bought the IBM PS1. I had learned how to use the 2400 baud generic Hayes modem that had come with the computer, and I'm ashamed to admit this, I was doing a little bit of BBS piracy at the time. So I had found Sim Farm on a pirate BBS. It was a couple of discs. Back then, downloads were split at specific sizes, just to make sure that it was manageable to get a download. Phone lines tended to be a little flaky, and in 1994-ish, there were very few good protocols out there. We forget that. Today, we use the TCP/IP protocol or FTP protocol, probably very rarely. But back then, there were many competing protocols in order to download files. Off the top of my head, I'm thinking the first protocol I know of for downloading files was one called Kermit. Kermit had no kind of CRC checks or file quality checks on it. There's another one called Xmodem, same kind of thing. Ymodem, I believe Ymodem allowed you to do batch file transfers. There was Zmodem, so you're sensing a theme here. It wasn't until later ones like, I want to say HS-Link, the bidirectional protocols that came out, that allowed you to check on the file's integrity as it was downloading, and even, you know, doing CRC checks so that it could re-download bad parts of the file midstream if somebody, let's say, my sister or my mom or my dad, picked up the telephone in the middle of a file transfer, which happened more often than not. So getting a small file or small program off of a BBS was a little tricky at 2400 baud. Remember, 2400 baud modems would download at about 0.3 kilobytes per second. That's 0.3 kilobytes per second. The average download for me took about one full hour, and that would monopolize the phone line, monopolize my computer for that entire hour. At being two disks long, two high density disks, meant that this would take at least 2 hours to download. And let's be honest, folks, I was living on a little acreage at the time. Our telephone line quality was not great. And this would often mean that the file transfer speed would dip below 0.3 kilobytes per second, sometimes down to 0.01 or 0.15. So very, very slow. I remember it taking about 2 to 3 hours to get it. When I finally did get it, oh, and by the way, another good reason for downloading small files off of BBSs was actually because this would cost you file credits. I'm not sure if anybody remembers this idea, but BBS operators, sysops, they didn't want people monopolizing their phone line, their only, usually only phone line, to download large amounts of data and then disappear. This was called leeching. They wanted to dissuade leeching, so the trick was they had a quota system. You were only able to download if you had uploaded a certain amount of data. This is not very familiar for the average, let's say, BitTorrent user who loves to leech. Back in those days, they wanted to really encourage people to interact with each other socially on the BBS or just not leech at all. So you were required to upload a certain amount of information. I didn't have much wares, being a 14-year-old kid with a very slow modem. So I would tend to focus on BBSs that would give me, you know, let's say, oh, I don't know, 2 megabytes of download credits to get me started. I would use that 2 megs to grab a game. I would take it to a different BBS who didn't have that game and use that 2 megabytes of credits to upload and share and get new credits that I could use on this other BBS. Usually sysops were fairly generous with the credit. They were called download ratios. So if you uploaded, it would be, for instance, a 1-to-2 or 1-to-5, sorry, I should say 2-to-1 or 5-to-1 download ratio, meaning for every 1 megabyte that you uploaded, you could download 5 megabytes, or at a different BBS, for every 1 megabyte you uploaded, you could get 2 megabytes of downloads. So I installed SimFarm on our IBM PS1, and something funny happened. My sister, who she was about a year and a half younger than me, had kind of long abandoned playing computer games. We had grown up together playing King's Quest IV, King's Quest V. More recently at the time, I think 93 maybe, or 92, we had played Quest for Glory 3 together. And we had kind of done this team play. I called it single player co-op, where kind of like a hot seat thing. There's one person in the chair at the keyboard and the other person sitting, co-pilot, sitting at the side, barking orders or giving suggestions or even reading through the hint book and helping you cheat your way through. That was the kind of relationship my sister and I had at the time for playing games. It was really wonderful. I have some warm memories of that. Well, she hadn't really played anything in a long time. And, you know, we're teenagers at this point, at each other's throats now and then. Our relationship had kind of weakened somewhat. And I had really missed playing games with her. And one day, I was really shocked. I came home and I found that she was playing Sim Farm. I had installed it and kind of forgot about it, let's be honest. I probably only really downloaded this game to use it as file upload credits at another BBS. So I sat beside my sister and watched her play Sim Farm, and I could just see that it was really intuitive. She was into it. She would spend hours at it building up this little farm and raising cattle and pigs and sheep, and I was really impressed. And I would ask her questions, and for the most part, I just kind of stayed silent beside her and watched her play. This was a funny kind of inversion of our previous relationship, which was I was the older brother. I would sit in the hot seat, play the game, and she would read hints to me or just watch me play as a younger sister. So this was kind of an interesting change in the way things work. And I have such wonderful memories of those couple of months my sister got back into Sim Farm. Now, there were drawbacks. This being a pirated game, we had no manual. But thankfully, Sim Farm was pretty intuitive. My sister had managed to figure out most of the commands. There was stuff we didn't quite understand, like how the economy worked. And as it turns out, that was probably a fairly randomly generated thing. But we also didn't understand how things like futures worked. We really did need the manual for those kinds of things. One wonderful thing that I can remember, and I'll cover this a bit later on, is using the crop dusting plane. We eventually figured out that if you upgraded the town to an airport, you could access and fly the crop duster. Unfortunately, we didn't know what the keyboard commands were to fly the crop duster. So we would fly it around in circles until inevitably, I think the thing either ran out of gas, or more often than not, we would just plummet it straight into the ground because we didn't know how to land it. Now that I own a real legit copy, I can tell you exactly how to fly the crop duster, and I'll talk about that a little bit later in the gameplay section. So one of the things that was really nice was, I would say 15, maybe 20 years later, this would be, 20, yeah, getting close to that, 20, almost 20 years later, I found a physical boxed copy of Sim Farm. I believe at the time I actually got it off of eBay. I've got it here with me right now. This, my little personal story here is now developed, blending into the current time. One thing I found was that the game has an absolutely wonderful manual. It's extremely thick, well-written, and the box art and cover art is absolutely beautiful. It's actually, I believe, if I look at the box here, it's a full-on pointillist drawing or painting. I'm not sure what pointillism counts as. I guess you'd call it painting of a kind. It's a really wonderful box cover, and I really encourage you to look it up. Inside the manual is one of the most comprehensive and honestly just plain old enjoyable manuals I've ever read. The manual not only talks about gameplay, but half of the manual, full 50%, is called Real Farms. And in the Real Farms part of the manual, they talk about a history of agriculture right from 9,000 BC onwards to modern times. And it's a really impressive amount of information. And I think it not only does justice to farming in general, but it also shows just how committed Maxis was to making these games slightly more educational software toys than games themselves. And towards the end of the book, this I'll get to this a little bit later on in the story, a little bit later on in the podcast, was actually turned out to be a major influence in my choice of vocation later on in life. So I'll get to this in a little while, but rest assured that if you do see a copy of Sim Farm for, I don't know, 10, 20 bucks, jump on it. It is absolutely worth getting, not only for the quality of the game, which I think is wonderful, but honestly, just the quality of the packed-in materials. It's very, very, very good. So let's get on to the main section of this game. Thank you. Sim Farm, if you've ever played Sim City, starts off in, let's say, in a slightly different manner. Sim City would be the famous top-down city simulation, what would we call it, software toy. That was Maxis's own word for to describe the genre. You basically have an overhead view of a map, and your job is to plunk down residential, commercial, and industrial areas. The focus is on a very macro relationship with the landscape. You don't build any individual homes. You don't build any individual businesses. You're working at, let's say, one tile is equivalent to about a quarter mile or quarter section. Sim Farm elects to be much more of a micro simulation, in which you are placing individual cattle on the screen, or individual tractors, or individual, you're going to spraying with individual crops, that kind of stuff. You can pick up and drop hay bales. So you have a very similar interface to SimCity, however, you're working on a much smaller scale. And that's reflected by the fact that, let's say, when you are looking at your map window, you're actually seeing most of your farm, the farmhouse, the crops laid out, etc. You're not looking, let's say, at a farm as one single block of territory. It blows up to the entire screen. Now, in terms of the way the game starts, SimCity, although it had multiple modes and ways of working, generally it would generate a random terrain, and you would start playing your game based on that random terrain unless you loaded a pre-made map. Sim Farm starts off a little differently. It's actually a little bit more like Railroad Tycoon, if you're familiar with that franchise. You're given a map of the continental United States, and you can pick which part of the states you are going to farm in. I think it gives you five or six different options. And now the trick is each geography of the United States differs in the amount of rainfall it gets, its average temperature, and its average wind speed. You might think of these a bit as sliders that you could adjust around to change the profile of the landscape. So you can either pick your own region in roughly, like I said, five or six different places in the United States, or you can go about and randomly generate your own terrain. I've always tended to design my own region. I've enjoyed that more. This means adjusting the slider for the average amount of rainfall, the average temperature you get, and the average wind speed yourself. You also get to choose whether the landscape has a river, a lake, or both. And then you click Generate World, and it procedurally generates a landscape composed of water, trees, kind of grassland, a homestead, and it'll randomly place a nearby town. Usually the town is quite a distance from the farm. The implication there is they're giving you enough space when you get rich enough to develop it and take over the surrounding landscape. Now, when you get into the game proper, you're enter with the editor window, so you're kind of dropped right into influencing the environment. You start off with a little farmstead and a fence surrounding it, and this kind of maps out your first, let's call it, quarter section of land. You don't really have anything except a bare plot in front of you with a bunch of stones. I can tell you your first job is going to be to select the bulldozer icon and bulldoze out all of those big stones in your way. I actually like this. That's a nice little touch from a kid who grew up on an acreage. I can tell you many hours are spent picking up stones from the field and sticking them in the ditch at the end of the road when you are a kid. No parent wants to do that job, so it always ends up being a kid's job. So you bulldoze out those stones, and you can basically lay down your first crop. There's no plowing, there's no preparation of the soil. The game automates all of that. You simply select a crop. It takes up a certain amount of space per crop. So I lied. I want to say that maybe the crop size is not maybe the land size that you initially start off with is a section of land, 640 acres. And if the land was split up into quarters, so 168 acres per quarter, each crop should take up about almost a quarter section of land, leaving just enough space for you to have things like a barn, a silo, and some feeding stuff for your animals. So on your starter map, you have probably just enough room to lay down four different crops. Now, one of the interesting things about this game is that it does maintain some of the more macro aspects of SimCity. You have a road building tool that turns out to be one of the most important parts of the game. In SimCity, roads simply function to reduce your taxpayers complaining about too much traffic or not enough roads. In this game, the purpose of roads is actually to reduce wear on your machinery. If your machinery is going over gravel roads, it will take a certain amount of damage. If it's over paved roads, which are much more expensive, they will take much less damage. And if your machinery is being driven on the stubble in the fields without any roads at all, you can be assured that it's going to age very, very quickly and require a replacement very soon. So one of your first jobs is going to be to select crops. So you have a pallet or swatch, let's say. Swatch is a better word for anybody who uses Photoshop. You have a swatch of a certain number of crops that you can select from, and you pick one of the crops you want to grow. In my case, I grew a combination of strawberries and tomatoes because those seem to be fairly high-grossing cash crops. You select one, you pick a place on your map that you want to grow it, and it has to be within your own territory, your own real estate. And you click, it plunks it down, you see a little tractor come out, and it does very, very quickly, especially running on the 486 DX4100 I have. It flies across the screen, tills up the soil as fast as possible, seeds the soil as fast as possible, and your tractor goes back in the barn. Now, here's a little bit of note of worth. When I was a kid, I didn't understand the difference between leasing and buying. Even though I was 14 years old, I understood basic economics. It didn't make sense to me that why anybody would want to rent something when they could buy it, or why would they buy something when they could rent it. The game uses, you can use this strategically in the game to minimize your costs. In my experience, you're just always better off to use your starting funds to buy yourself a basic tractor, buy yourself some seed, buy fertilizer, herbicides, all of that other stuff, and stick it in a shed that you've built, or perhaps even a barn. If you use the auto lease function, which is under your options menu, every time you need to use a tool that you don't own, for instance, let's say you need to do some seeding and you don't have a seeder, it will rent the seeder for a certain amount of money, let's say from the bank, or, you know, that's never specified who you're renting it from. It just automatically leases it for you. Now, this became a little bit of a problem for me because in the game, I turned off auto lease because I wanted to manage my own money. I didn't like the idea of the computer automatically renting stuff whenever it needed to. This ran me into a huge problem recently because I forgot that if you don't have auto lease turned on, or auto purchase or auto buy, I believe is the word for it, it won't automatically do things like buy you seed when you don't own that seed. What was happening for me was, and I should probably talk about this in the gameplay section, it's not exactly relevant now, but I'll do it now. I actually ended up not being able to plant crops because I didn't own the seed, and there was no error message to tell me that I forgot to buy seed. So I would just have these bare fields. This was very recently. I was like, I can't understand. Why is my field not growing? It's bare. I'm expecting this crop to be done in like 4 to 6 weeks, and it's still brown. And I thought, okay, maybe I planted the crop at the wrong time of year. Maybe the temperature is too cold. No. It's because I forgot to turn on auto buy and I didn't own the seed to plant the field. So silly me. I'll get to that a little bit later in the gameplay section. Back to the to the style of the game. One thing I did notice, which is quite fun and funny, you don't see this too often in games, which tend to maintain a quite similar scale type for each land tile. The farm tiles are very zoomed in. Like I said, it tends to be more micromanagement style of gameplay. But then when you scroll over to the town itself actually uses fairly, let's say, large scale SimCity style tiles. So this is a kind of a weird thing. Your farm is very zoomed in, and yet the town is very zoomed out. Anyway, just stylistically an interesting choice. I don't know of any games that do that. Now, what is SimFarm really about? Let's call this American SimFarm stylistically. The entire farming model is based on industrial agribusiness. That means you're not going to be out hand plowing, or you won't have an oxen pulling plows, or you're not going to be managing your manure reserves to manure your fields from cow poop. You are working with big business, large fields, machinery for everything, and the only time you are going to see human beings out on that landscape, this is interesting politically, is when you get workers to harvest the field. You see these, I actually didn't know what they were when I was a kid. I thought they were locusts or something. These little funny colored shapes show up on the field during harvest time. Those are supposed to be people, and which seem to be nothing better than poorly paid slaves out to harvest your potatoes and your strawberries. Now, that, like I said, I call it American Sim Farm just because that tends to be the agricultural model used in North America. Let's say if this was a more European style farming game, I suspect you'd see something a little bit more hands-on, maybe of the ilk of Stardew Valley, where there's just less land available, meaning you can't afford to have thousands and thousands of acres of land to do your farming. You're going to be farming on a much smaller scale, more intensively. So I thought that was actually quite a fascinating thing. As an adult, I can appreciate this. As a kid, you bet I didn't know the difference between agribusiness and organic gardening, let's say. Now, visually, I noticed that the game, and this blew my mind when I figured this out. The game runs in a 16-color mode. Now, I'm here to talk about the Windows 3.1 version of the game, but I really have to talk about this later in the technical errata section of the podcast. I was shocked when I found out this game was 16 colors, because when I originally played this for MS-DOS back in 94, the game appeared to be 256 color. The colors were so rich and vibrant and sharp that I was quite sure this was a 256 color VGA game running in high res. The game is running at 640 by 480 in high res mode, or alternately, let me check the box here. I believe the game also supports, I don't have it written down. It supports an EGA mode, which is 640, I think, by something closer to 640 by 350. Here it is. EGA or VGA graphics card and color monitor. EGA supports 16 colors at 640 by 350. VGA, of course, as I said, at 16 colors by 640 by 480. I always played the game in 640 by 480, but again, to this day, it blows my mind that it actually is a 16-color game, just given how sharp and the color palette is. So, in terms of gameplay story, there is no real story, as is typical of the Maxis Sim genre. You're just kind of thrown in medias res, if you understand that term. You're kind of thrown into the situation and sink or swim. In this case, I would say the story is basically you're given a bunch of starting cash, you've got a little plot of land you can start your farm on, and you go. Now, what I find interesting and special about Sim Farm is that, to my knowledge, it is the only Sim game, and I'm probably going to have to go back on this someday because I'll find out there are plenty of exceptions, but to my knowledge, it's the only Sim game that actually has an end game scenario. Yes, you can actually fail at this game. You can have a game over screen, which basically happens when you run out of money and the bank forecloses on your farm. So that was a bit of a surprise. I was personally never able to force the end game scenario. I ended up reading this on a bunch of forums. Actually, they were I'm not sure how to pronounce this. Abandonia or Abandonia. This is the Abandonware website. The forums were very good for hardcore Sim Farm players who would describe strategies for playing the game. One of them had actually figured out how to lose the game and force foreclosure of his farm and loss of all of his assets. So that was kind of interesting to find out that there is an endgame scenario that you can trigger. So let's talk a little bit about gameplay. Again, the way the game's set up is you have a toolbar on the left. The toolbar allows you to select certain icons that will let you influence the landscape. So for instance, there's a bulldozer. There is a plant button. If you click on the plant button, it'll ask you which crop you want to plant. You select, let's say, I don't know, sorghum or wheat, and click somewhere on the map. And if it's a valid plantable space and it's got enough room to do it, there are no rocks in the way, for instance, the tractor will come out and plant the land for you with that crop. There are plenty of other buttons to use there, but one thing I've noticed is it's a very, very simplified UI compared to many of the other Sim games. I think accessibility was definitely one of the most important parts of how this game was designed. Now, up in the tool menu, you have a few important things that are lurking up there that you'll really need to use. One of them is the weather dialog box. It's a beautifully, very visually appealing little weather interface. So instead of just showing you a bunch of numbers and gauges, it actually shows you a wonderful hand-drawn, let's say, view outside of your kitchen window of the landscape, and it'll show you visually whether it's storming, whether it's sunny, whether it's cloudy that day, or snowing. I thought this was just very charming when I was a kid, and I still find it charming, partly due to the high quality artwork that was drawn for the game. That's something I want to talk about a little bit later on in the technical errata. So once you've got your crop planted, you can click the a magnifying glass, and this is kind of, let's call it, an object inspector or the inspector tool. Anything you click on, this will give you more information about. So you click on your crop and it'll show you some really important information. It's going to show you where the crop is in terms of its development, when it's expecting to be harvested. The crops have set times that they require to harvest. They need a certain amount of light and heat over a certain amount of days in order to go through gestational stages all the way until full fruit production and harvest. So you're going to want to keep an eye on this to time your next crop. You're going to notice that there's a bit of a timeline, and the timeline will show you visibly when you can expect to harvest the crop if it's growing properly. One thing I learned, which is really important, and I didn't know this as a kid, is you can kind of buffer ahead, let's say. You can pre-buffer which crop is going to come in next. So if you know your harvest date is in, let's say, 4 weeks, and the game automatically will auto-replant the exact same crop. So if it was a tomato field, it'll harvest the tomatoes and it'll replant it again as tomatoes. Well, what if I want rye growing there instead? Well, all I need to do is click the cut button, click on the area where you want the field to be harvested, and you can stick a new crop in there. So that's really helpful in order to switch crops in midstream on a field, or you can wait until the end of the harvest and switch crops then. That's something I didn't quite figure out when I was a kid and became very useful in terms of planning out the crops. Now, that is, let's say, the crop growing aspect. You can also be a livestock farmer. With livestock, what tends to happen is you buy your first few livestock, let's say cows. Cows are an easy place to start. You have a certain buy-in price. It's fixed. I can't remember what the buy-in price is right off the top of my head. I think it's around $250 per head. And it's like a little hand of God icon. You can just drop cattle all over your farm. I tend to drop a bunch of cattle. I buy a bunch of hay and drop a bunch of hay icons everywhere. And then I drop one watering trough near a water source. And what happens is the cattle will go on their own business. As long as they have hay and water and it helps to have a shelter, a barn, for instance, they will procreate occasionally. You'll hear this sound of a cow going moo or a sheep going baa, and you will have, that'll be the sound of a new animal being born. So that would be, let's call it a cow and calf operation, meaning you keep your cows so that they procreate and create new cattle. The other option is growing them just to the age that they're old enough to harvest and selling off the beef as a, you know, a meat operation. That's another option. Both are very, very profitable. I just found it fun to leave the livestock in the pens and let them procreate as they want to. There are very many other options you have for livestock, sheep, chickens, I can't remember. This is one of those good times that I took the manual. I don't think I ever grew chickens myself personally. I know pigs are there for sure, and sheep. So that's your other option in terms of, I'm flipping through the manual here because I want to double check this. oh, wow. The manual actually doesn't list the, oh, here we go. So our options are not chicken. It is cow, pig, sheep, or horse. A little pro tip here, almost everyone on the forums agreed that horses were probably your best bet for livestock production. Now, the only thing bad about horses is they only mate after 4 years. Cattle mate after 15 to 20 months. So you can see there's an interesting game loop here. The game keeps track of, and I'm assuming this is a very object-oriented style game development process. Each cow has a certain gestational period. They have a certain amount of food that they require, and a certain amount of time before they can mate again. So it keeps track of this information. Each cow, pig, sheep, or horse will mate on its own accord. You don't have to worry about male and female. As far as the game's concerned, as long as there are two of something, they can mate together. another important resource to worry about is your water. The game has plenty of water sources located in relation to the farm. The most important thing you're going to do in the game is to put a pump near a water source and then run an irrigation canal from that water source to your planted land. So let's say if you've got a square that is growing wheat, you are going to want to run irrigation ditches on the left and right sides of that quarter section. And then you're also going to want to place a valve. The irrigation valve allows you to turn the water on or off for that section. I find that it helps to place two valves on each quarter section, right at the, let's say, the start of where the irrigation ditch or canal connects to the quarter section. This allows you to fine-tune the amount of water entering the quarter section. For crops that have very high water requirements, I'm thinking of things like tomatoes and strawberries, they're going to want a lot more water than, let's say, grassland-based crops like wheat and rye, which want a lot less water. You will see problems like flooding. Now, let's talk a little bit about problems. I know this is a long podcast. Wow, I'm almost at the 50-minute point here. Let's talk about problems you're going to have. Well, you're going to run into a variety of issues. The recurrent problems that you'll expect due to your farming practices, your agri practices, are going to be either too much water or too little. You will have invasions of bugs, which are going to chew up your crops. You might have, and that would be pests, basically. You will have problems with bacterial infections, so you'll require a herbicide for that, or fungal infections in your crop, which require a fungicide. There's one more missing. Oh, and you might have too little fertilizer applied to the field, so your plants will slow down. So every time one of those issues come up, you're going to see a little icon pop up over the crop, and it'll tell you what the current need or problem is with that crop. In my case, it's almost always the same. At some point, the crop exhausts the amount of fertilizer available in that field. I need to send out the tractor with some fertilizer and spray with fertilizer. If you see a little green caterpillar come up, that means you've got a pest problem, so spray with pesticides. If you see some kind of sickly looking, I don't know what to call them, brown plants, that's probably due to a bacterial infection. That's a herbicide you're going to need. And there's also one for applying fungicides. So that's what's to come up. There are also, of this being a Maxis game, and let's say Will Wright style humor, there are also a disasters menu, which is always a very hilarious thing to do to your crops. It's not that funny, to be honest, when you've got a very expensive crop that's going to earn you $15,000-$16,000 out there, and a locust swarm shows up and chews up your entire crop. This is almost a little bit like the earthquake experience in SimCity. although the nice thing is the locust swarm will only target one crop on your land. So you can, of course, turn disasters on or off. I always leave them on just because it adds a little bit of silliness to the game. Now, in terms of gameplay, one critical thing I learned was, and this is something I didn't know because I did not own the a registered licensed copy of the game, is that you can use the file menu to load crops. This is critical. The designer, Eric Albers, whom I'll talk about a little bit in a few minutes, allowed you to add or remove custom crops from the game. So I had no idea you could load up things like oranges as a crop. There are a ton of extra crops included with the game in the crops subfolder of the installation. As I said, this functions a little bit like a palette swatch. So you can swap out one crop for another. I believe you're limited to 16 crops. Don't skewer me if I get that number wrong. I think it's about 16 crops, which would make sense given the data storage menu methods that the programmer was using. So please, yes, explore the file load crops submenu, because you're going to find a lot of custom crops in the game that aren't loaded, let's say, as the default swatch. Now, let's talk about nice surprises. Well, there were a couple of nice changes that were made with SimFarm with its transition from DOS to Windows 3.1, the DOS version coming out first, this being a port of the original DOS version. They've changed the plant and spray buttons from just words that say plant and spray, which seemed a little out of place on the toolbar, into real icons, which makes a lot more sense. The Windows 3.1 version comes with an electronic version of the manual, which I thought was very good. Now, this isn't, let's say, Adobe PDF quality back in the day. This is more of a Windows Help interactive experience, something like HyperCard on the Mac, which has hot clickable links, hyperlinks, so you can jump between different topics. I thought it was quite well written. And again, this is an electronic version of the paper version that's in the box, probably because SimFarm was re-released on CD-ROM, which was just a plain old jewel case at the time, and they weren't about to print off that huge manual for a jewel case. So let's talk a little bit about not so nice surprises. I didn't expect to even have to add this section, but let's say after 20 some odd years, there are some interesting, let's say, features, bugs, that I noticed with the game that are actually a little bit on the annoying side. The Windows version has a less visually appealing color palette than the DOS version, even though both are exactly 16 colors. This actually was quite a shock for me. I thought the Windows 3.1 version would be at least as good as, or perhaps better than, the DOS version, because it came out much later. And I thought that they may, for instance, offer 256 color graphics. The opposite turned out to be true. The Windows version palette is of much poorer quality than the palette used in the DOS version. And not only has the palette shifted, I shouldn't say shifted, has been completely replaced, the dithering style has changed too. I can't describe to you how the dithering looks on the DOS version, but I can assure you that if you look at the DOS version on Mobi games, the dithering style is very rich. Now, dithering being this a method where you put two colors beside each other to create either comparison or contrast. And usually dithering is done things like done in styles like random dithering, which would just be to randomly place colors in relationship to each other. Or you would have, trying to remember my different types of dithering here. That would be random noise dithering. And the DOS version has what I would call, and I'm borrowing from Photoshop here, very attractive form of pattern and diffusion dithering. Pattern dithering being the type of dithering used in Sierra games. Diffusion dithering being a little bit more like building a gradient from one color to another. You can see this most obviously on the intro screen for the game, where it has the cow picture on the side of an old wooden crate. The DOS version is absolutely breathtaking. I encourage any artist out there to take a look at this as a perfect example of not only how to dither, but how to do it in 16 colors. Incredible work. Now, compare that to the Windows version. Unfortunately, not only has the wonderful mix of dithering styles gone away, being replaced by purely random noise and diffusion dithering, but it's also lost some colors in that process, electing to use a few different types of gray instead of which were much richer colors. So unfortunately, the Windows 3.1 version visually, I can't recommend all that much. This is simply due to, again, a change in the palette. Now, this might be something forced by Windows 3.1. I actually don't know a lot about how color management worked in the Windows 3.1. I'm assuming this game was probably built with WinG. I don't know how that worked, and I don't know how restrictive Windows was in the colors you were able to use in your games. So I'm going to leave that as an open-ended question. Let's say in the life of this podcast, let's hope that we run across this issue again so I can provide you with some kind of answer. Not so nice surprises. Little minor things. They removed the question mark in the toolbar, which got rid of context sensitive help, which would just tell you what the other item icons on the toolbar is. That's covered in the help file. They just basically say, well, we removed the question mark tool because this is already covered in the help menu, so use the help menu when you can. They also removed something called the history arrow. And this history button allowed you to read a buffer of the last few messages that the game had prompted you with. I thought this was actually a really, really helpful thing. It'll give you scroll back, basically, on dealing with system messages from the game. And I thought this was a really useful thing that they unfortunately removed. I'm not quite sure why. Now, technically, all I have to say about the game is that it requires Windows 3.1 to be running in 386 enhanced mode. And here's a nice little tip. The README file says you can force Windows to restart in 386 enhanced mode by typing win/3, that's /3, instead of win.com to start. I actually didn't know that. That's a nice little trick. Keep in mind, I'm always running in Windows 386 enhanced mode. I've never once dropped to standard mode in Windows, and I can't imagine a good reason why. If you know a little bit more about how standard mode related to Windows 386 enhanced mode, I'd love to hear about it. That's something we'll cover in a future episode. Now, I've got a new section for this game, and I'm hoping to add it to future sections. This is the hacking section. This is one of the first games I've covered that's got some great hacks behind it. A programmer by the name of De Programmer, or DE Programmer, created a homebrew crop editor. I thought this was just fascinating. The crop editor was a tool, like let's say a Windows tool, offered or promised in the SimFarm official guide. This would be the, I think it was called the SimFarm Almanac. I have yet to find a copy of this either as a PDF or as a physical copy. This guide on the very last page advertised it as a little tool from Leaping Lizard Software, which would allow you to customize and create your own crops. I thought, what an awesome idea this was. Now, either due to the fact that Leaping Lizard Software didn't sell this officially, or perhaps that Leaping Lizard software disappeared very soon after this game came out. I don't know if anybody who owns a copy of the crop editor, and I haven't been able to find that anywhere, and neither did this person named D Programmer. So D Programmer spent a lot of time doing, let's say, byte level or bit level analysis using a hex editor, I think, on the game's different files. Eventually figured out the data structures, let's call them, of each type of file. So there's, and he actually has a description of each type. I can add that as a link in the show notes. And built his own tool, his own homebrew crop editor. I was really excited to see this. Now, unfortunately, the file download has disappeared off of the web. I've tried to find it from three or four different places with no luck, unfortunately. I'm going to try again with archive.org, but I wasn't having a lot of luck finding it. So I have sent a message to Dprogrammer on Reddit. I'm hoping this person gets back to me and I'm able to find this. If I do find it, I will most definitely post a link and I will probably host it on VGA256.com because I thought, what a wonderful little project for a game that was, you know, not so celebrated. So finally, let's talk development story or development history. Wow. Nobody tell Joe Mastriani that I just stole his idea. The development history. Sim Farm was created by Maxis developer Eric Albers. Although Moby Games credits his company Leaping Lizard Software for Sim Farm, I actually don't see a single mention of that company name in any of the Sim Farm documentation. The game appears to have been built in-house by Maxis when Eric Albers was still its employee. Now, thinking about this, how does this work? Well, it's probably a little bit more complicated than that. Knowing from the history of Broderbund Software, for instance, and the developer who created the Prince of Persia series, what often happened was they would have a developer working inside the building who was technically not in-house. This is a really odd thing. You'll also see this in the Leisure Suit Larry series. People like developers like Al Lowe, for instance, worked for Sierra building the Leisure Suit Larry series, but he was actually not a Sierra employee. He was a contracted employee. I suspect this is probably why Eric Albers says Leaping Lizard Software created the game. Maxis says Maxis created the game. Probably because Leaping Lizard Software was contracted to build the game from Maxis. Now, let's remember that Leaping Lizard Software is Eric Albers. This isn't anybody else. Now, that's not to say that the entire game was built by him alone. The documentation, especially a lot of the research that went into the game, were in-house Maxis employees, and I was surprised by the size of the development team that went into this. So I'm not going to go through the contributions of each and every employee. We're going to focus on Eric Albers himself. But I think it's really, really important, just given the scope of research that went into this game, that other people do deserve credit for that. Now, let's talk about Eric, the Maxis employee. Albers is quite of a Renaissance man, let's say, of his own description. He describes himself as a hobbyist who's interested in genetics, physics, math, electronics, robots, metallurgy, I'm never sure what the right way to say that word is, beekeeping, carpentry, music, and writing. Let's add to that programming. So he recounts that he played keyboard in a band during high school and college and did some musical composition in the 90s. None of his musical composition work made it into games he was creating because he tended to focus on programming, which was, of course, paying the bills for him. He does note, however, and I thought this was very interesting, he got an audio credit on Sim Farm for helping make some of the fun sounds in the game. Now, Eric Albers started his career with Silent Software, game career, I should say. Silent Software was headed by a man with the unlikely name of Baron Reichart von Wolfshield. No joke, that is his actual name. Silent Software is probably best known for its Amiga games like Firepower and Galactic Invasion, or a C64 licensed title that I think people will probably recognize, Die Hard. My memory of Silent Software was another licensed title called Who Framed Roger Rabbit. This was a pretty exciting and edgy cartoon for me as a kid, and the fact that they got a license for this says to me that they were probably at the right place at the right time in the late 1980s, early 1990s. Most impressively, Baron Reichard von Wolfschild's, I'm not sure if it's Wolfschild or Wolfschild, there's two different spellings online, pioneered some cell animation technology to make the game. They called onion skinning, referring to the tendency to for cell animators to flip through other pages in order to see where a character has been on previous pages. The cell animation emulation technology that they developed to create Roger Rabbit became actually a new title called Disney's Animation Studio. And again, Eric Albers is given a credit for special magic on Who Framed Roger Rabbit. He worked as a programmer for Silent Software at the time, so it's imaginable that he helped to write the onion skinning animation engine, which again went on into Disney's Animation Studio. So I don't know that for sure. I wasn't able to get a hold of Eric Albers, unfortunately. So in 1993, this would be shortly, perhaps during the development time he had at Maxis Software, working on other games, he founded Leaping Lizard Software, which was sold in 2000. And after that, he retired from the game industry and moved on to a different sector of the tech industry. Now, question is, where can you buy or download Sim Farm? Unfortunately, this is one of those games that has not hit GOG or Steam, probably because of the Windows 3.1 requirement. I thought that was really unfortunate because this is the kind of game that would have done really well. In fact, there's no reason that it couldn't be on GOG right now, just because there is a DOS version of the game. So my suggestion is, first thing to check is, honestly, it's worth grabbing a legit copy off of eBay. It'll cost you next to nothing, because this was not one of the most popular games ever made. And also for the fact, and this should always work in our favor, the current rage right now is PC-based DOS games. Well, Windows 3.1 games are really getting neglected, meaning you can get things for cheap. So I really recommend it. It's worth it, if only to read that wonderful manual. If you manage to find a Sim Farm, a copy of the Sim Farm Almanac, I'd love to hear from you. So I apologize, this episode ran really, really long. I'm glad that I was able to get back on the saddle here after a lot of delay, unnecessary delay. Next week, I don't have an episode planned out yet, so I can't give you a heads up, but I am looking forward to talking to you in 1 week. So have a wonderful week, and I will talk to you again next Sunday. Super VGA out.